Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Matt Gallagher, welcome back to Angry Planet. Thank you for coming on. Last time you were on, it was all about controversy and not a whole lot about your book. I thought you deserved and the audience deserved to actually hear about the new novel, and it would perhaps give me a chance to read it, which I have now done. It's excellent. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Can you tell us, it's called Daybreak. Can you tell us what it's about?
Sure. It is fiction. It's a novel, though certainly heavily influenced by real-world events. It follows two U.S. military veterans of Afghanistan into Ukraine at the onset of the renewed Russian invasion in early 2022. One of those American vets, Han Lee, is soldier. He's found life working at Best Buy deeply unfulfilling and wants to get back into the thick of things. Tells a Ukrainian recruiter in chapter two of the book, he wants to shoot a fucking Russian invader in the face, and he means it. And frankly, Ukraine probably needs people like that. You know, that's when Zelensky put out the call asking for military veterans from the West to come join their defense. People like Han Lee are probably who he was hoping to attract. The other veteran and kind of our book's main character is named Luke Paxton. He served in Afghanistan with Lee, but is going over for more muddled reasons. He has kind of vague notions about wanting to help, but he's not kind of obsessed with getting back into the fight the way Lee is. His life has really been stuck in neutral ever since coming back his tour in Afghanistan, and he kind of wants to shake that. He suffers from a pretty severe PTSD, I'd say. And, you know, like a lot of people with that diagnosis, whether they got it from combat or a car accident or whatever, he's just kind of been trapped there. Part of the reason he decides that Ukraine might be able to shake him out of this is an old love, a Ukrainian woman named Svetlana Dovbush, who he lost touch with 10 years before, right around the same time he deployed to Afghanistan. And now he's hoping to seek out. It's probably not too much of a spoiler to say that she does become a character in the book.
We'll do some light conversation around themes up here at the top, but I do maybe in 30 minutes or so we'll give a spoiler warning and then kind of dive in to some other stuff, if that's all right. I think it's a more interesting conversation, and like when you've read the book, I find myself wanting to talk about the last 50 pages more than anything. But we can get to that.
Okay.
So what inspired this? Why did you want to write this?
So I've been over to Ukraine myself as both a volunteer and a journalist, 3 times now. And over the course of those trips, I became keenly aware that I was, meeting people who wouldn't go on record, hearing anecdotes second or third hand, maybe stories or encounters that I couldn't necessarily source for a magazine fact checker, but were real interesting. And they were interesting because they were messy, right? It wasn't white in that here's this pure, noble defense of a democracy, which it is. But it also wasn't black either in terms of, you know, pick whatever conspiracy theory you want from the interweb. In many cases, the Westerners I met over there, in whatever capacity they were working in, were complicated. They were flawed. Wasn't a coincidence that many of them brought up their experiences in Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq or even a couple other places as really the seeding for why they felt they needed to be in Ukraine. That here maybe was a just cause, a necessary cause that they'd been neglected from sometime over the last 20 plus years. I found that really compelling. And there were different versions of these people. Some were very deeply practical. You know, the retired Green Beret medic knows exactly how he can contribute to the cause and help the Ukrainian people. Then there were some people kind of like Pax. Maybe their heart's in the right place. Maybe they're even able to contribute in some small way once they find the right people, but they're kind of looking around for that. And in some cases, just getting in the way and clogging up the pipeline. So I just kind of, I don't know. I'd written fiction before. I'd written two novels before this one. So I knew I could do it. And it just kind of felt like the better place to kind of explore these messy grays that I, you know, fascinate me as both as a writer and as a human being.
What is it that you can do with a novel that you can't get away with a piece of journalism?
I think in some ways it has to make more sense. The story has to be cleaner. It needs to be smoother than the hard jagged edges that reality allow for. You know, the easy writer answer here is to talk about emotional truce. And yeah, that's all true. But I think really good journalism, really good creative nonfiction can find that. What I find compelling about fiction, at least for me, is it's harder. It really is. I can't just end this section saying, well, that's the way it is. You know, find some pithy quote that, you know, a Ukrainian or American volunteer gave me and let it linger in the ether or whatever. No, everything has to align. I'm pleased to hear that, you know, the last 50 pages you found compelling. The book is intentionally structured to be a slow burn until those last 50 pages or so. And then it kind of really shifts into overdrive. That was intentional. You know, I had to chip away at that structurally to make it work. Whereas, you know, journalism, you know, most of my pieces from Ukraine have been more kind of profile pieces, and I'm glad to do it. I love writing it. It's challenging in its own way, but it's more like a puzzle. Whereas this is, I don't know, cutting a diamond or something.
There's a sense in both this book and Youngblood, which is the first novel, right? That was the first. Okay. Of an American soldier out of their depth and doing archaeology, if that makes sense, like exploring this country, and trying to trying to get an answer to some question that maybe doesn't have one. And I was wondering if you saw those parallels between Youngblood and Daybreak.
I did. You know, I don't know how intentional it was from the beginning. I did an event a couple weeks back up in Buffalo, and my friend and fellow author, Brian Kastner, and his gave a real kind introduction and said that the thing that he likes about my work is that I write about the everyman, right? You know, we kind of live in an era of special operations and specialized warfare and experts and all this stuff. And I'm fascinated by that as much as the next reader. It's certainly not my background, though. You know, I'm kind of interested in the regular, you know, in the Youngblood's case, the regular lieutenant or the regular private that found themselves in Iraq trying to make the best of a really deeply messed up situation years into the war. You know, in Ukraine, but, you know, as a journalist, I was drawn to kind of the everyday people that found themselves over there. You know, on a practical level, they were more willing to talk to me. You know, finding the black shadow guy, you know, they don't want to talk to Esquire magazine. They got a business to get. They got guns to run. They got clandestine operations to conduct. You know, the everyman. He'll tell me a story over a pint of beer at the expat bar. And it's also, I think it's just what I'm drawn to as a writer. The technical details of war, the weapons and all that stuff, again, it's just not my strength. You know, if I have one as a writer of war, I've been doing this 10 plus years now. I think it's the human stories. What made people go over there? What are the real reasons? What are the real reasons they went over there as opposed to the reasons they tell people? What's it like being received into a culture and society that you're not super familiar with? From the Ukrainian perspective, what is that experience like? When most of the men in your neighborhood or town go to the front, and then all of a sudden there's a bunch of strange Westerners walking around saying they're there to help. There's a lot of different answers to these questions, and then teasing them out of people. I don't know. I enjoy it. I enjoy it, and then I enjoy reshaping it and trying to make it cohesive and coherent for readers back home.
Yeah, Pax and Lee are both very interesting because they are. Pax, well, he worked at like an AutoZone. I don't think you call it an AutoZone, but he worked at a chain mechanic shop. Lee worked at a Best Buy. Their war has gone by, right?
Yep.
And civilian life is not everything it was cracked up to be. I think as a Marine once put it to me, he was so happy to get out. He was so happy to get out of the force, or he was so happy to get out of the Marines. So he was so tired of all the military bullshit. Then, like a couple years into civilian life, he realized that the civilian bullshit was much, much worse.
Yeah, it's a tried and true trajectory. And I've had moments where I've felt similarly. Finding a purpose, I think, is something a lot of veterans, particularly combat veterans, talk about once they get out. I speak that language. I know the story. I can viscerally connect with it a bit. But I've been able to be a writer. My blog got shut down when I was still a punk lieutenant, right? So I've been doing this even before I got out of uniform. It gave me that purpose. I haven't had to, on the meter of needing new purpose, missing the military. Lee is at a 98, Paxton's at a 90. I'm at a 12. Personally, but I can speak. I know what that feels like. I can talk to those people. I can pull out the complexities of that to form a interesting story for civilians who don't know anything about this. So, in some ways I've been very blessed to not make that journey or to make the journey just enough that I can recognize its contours.
Do you think America does a bad job of giving people that purpose after they get out of the military? Is even their responsibility?
That's a fine question. I've gone back and forth on this over the last 10 plus years. I don't know if it's, I think life is difficult for us all. Finding purpose in life is difficult for us all. Becoming a civilian isn't a bad thing. It's not necessarily a good thing. It's just a thing. It's a thing that we're all going to have to do, whether you stay do a 3-year stint, or you retire after 30 from the Pentagon. I just think it's difficult because there is just that immediate sense of purpose in the military, deployed or otherwise, and you get used to kind of working within a team that is really foreign in a lot of civilian jobs. I've been out for so long, I couldn't talk about what the state of the transition is like. It was bad when I got out of the Army in 2009. It's probably better now. It's probably still not great. Is it America's responsibility? Somewhat. The VA's motto is, from the Lincoln, the old Lincoln quote for he or she who born the battle. But it's frankly, it's also on the vet, on the individual vet. Nobody's going it's tough. It's right or wrong. It's you're going to have to do it yourself more often than not. And finding something that gives you purpose, whether it's on a family level, whether it's another job, whether it's giving back and serving. I think there's a lot of really great service organizations out there that have kind of harnessed veterans' instinct and energy in a real substantial way. Team Rubicon comes to mind. The Mission Continues is another. But I don't know. I do have a slight slight streak that wants to, the older, maybe I'm just getting old and cranky as I get into middle age, but like it is kind of on us too.
What is it that drives the people that you talked to? What is it that drives people to go over there after they, to go to Ukraine? I mean, is there a profile of the vet that goes over there and does that? Are they all saying the same kind of thing? Are the reasons as varied as they are?
One constant, and I mean, there's a lot of different reasons. There's a lot of different types. You know, there's the guy willing to go to the front line. There's the guy who wants to work with a humanitarian organization, handing out tourniquets or working, you know, teaching combat medicine. There's the guy that, you know, just wants to hang out in Lviv and kind of sniff the fumes of war from afar. Consistently, what happened in their deployment, their previous deployments when they served, and not just America, I met Brits and Canadians and Australians, Spaniard. What happened varied, but they always brought up some lingering thing from their previous war, right? So they like, and so that's part of what makes it complicated, what makes it messy, what I wanted to explore in fiction was, is it fair to be bringing baggage from another war to this war? And there is no easy answer to that, because sometimes that baggage makes this person very useful and has making them a very driven individual. You know, there are ex operators very near the front, serving in a myriad of ways, directly and pragmatically. And the Ukrainian, it's a small part of it, but the Ukrainian defense has benefited from them. And then there's the other types, and there's probably a bit more of them who are kind of getting in the way, or they're just trying to make money, or they're to meet a woman. And they give everyone a bad rap. And but parsing, you know, what has been interesting is each trip, how observing how much better the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian society has gotten at parsing those two groups. You know, our first trip, we were there so early, you know, they were just grateful for anyone who's, you know, you could say whatever, and they would believe you. And, you know, there's some harrowing accounts that emerged out of like the Battle of Kyiv, for example, in early March 2022, where if you were Western, they gave you a gun and they just told you to point it in the right direction. And some of those guys were up for that, and some of those guys were completely overwhelmed. So I don't know. There was an answer somewhere in there.
I'm interested in this idea of, I mean, this is definitely at the root of what's going on with PAX, of being haunted by your last war. Is it a sense of needing to have a do-over to make something right that happened in the previous war? I'm guessing the answer is always different, right? But I've been thinking about this sense, thinking about my friends that served and thinking about the fall of Afghanistan. Sorry about the cat, if you can hear that. That maybe not necessarily that our generation was cheated, but that they got the wrong war, or the war was handled in the wrong way. And it's not the same as Vietnam, because it feels like the tragedy is different, but there's this sense that you had one soldiering life to give, and it was used incorrectly. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I got that, you know, it's a self-selected group, obviously, because they're over there, but that is exactly what I heard in chorus from Western veterans in Ukraine. You know, there are people that disagree with that, but they're not going to be in Ukraine. And, you know, say they joined up in the aftermath of 9/11, or even if they were already serving, that's like it's impossible to describe to people who weren't alive yet or don't remember that. But like the sense of like a clear just cause was very real and very palpable, and it all disappeared very quickly. And I think a lot of us, to include myself to some degree, will be chasing that high until we croak. And you know, what does that mean for, is that Ukraine's problem? Not at all. But that doesn't mean that they can't benefit from some of these hard-earned experiences that that everyday people can help in a meaningful but small direct way. You know, I'm an Iraq guy, but it's not a coincidence I made these guys, Pax and Lee, Afghanistan vets. Kabul fell 6 months before Ukraine. I wanted their hurt. I wanted their, at least in Lee's case, their sense of moral injury to be very fresh. I was struck when Kabul fell, talking with my friends who were Afghanistan vets, how shocked they were, how hurt they were. And I had, you know, just a little bit of emotional distance as an Iraq guy to be like, are you really that surprised? You know, shouldn't, like, maybe you didn't think it would be happen so quickly or just like this, but didn't you think some version of this was, you know, that's, and I lambasted myself for thinking that, because it's very harsh and judgmental. Because then I went back to, you know, 2014 when ISIS rolled into Iraq, and a version of that, not maybe not quite as pronounced because it wasn't quite so sudden. It wasn't the totality of Iraq. You know, the Iraqi military dug in, and actually the exact village we were stationed in is where the Iraqi army dug in and finally pushed back ISIS, and then, you know, spent the next few years taking everything back. It was deeply unfair of me, but that was my initial reaction. And so I kind of wanted to play with that and give, in their different ways, Pax and Lee that kind of fresh rage, fresh baggage that they haven't even begun parsing through, even though their war, or at least their part of the war, ended 10 years prior.
Afghanistan is so, the reactions to Afghanistan are so fascinating, because it's one of these things where, like, it was like there was a certain amount of the American populace that had walled itself off and just assumed that was going to be forever, that we were going to be there forever, that it was just going to be kind of a status quo, money and personnel sink forever to keep that thing going. Then coupled with the shock of how fast it all happened, and what a piss poor job America did at getting people out safely. So I'm wondering if it had been more of a slow unwinding instead of just a brutal rapid shock, if it would have played differently in people's consciousness.
Probably, at least for some people. The comparison I remember being bandied about in the month, you know, I mean, just the arrogance of withdrawing around the September 11th anniversary, right? When there's an actual fighting season just a couple months away, that, you know, it would have at least given the Afghan government a couple months to stabilize. Like, it's like we learned nothing. But the comparison I remember being bandied about, I don't know, early August 2021 was, well, you know, even the South Vietnamese military held on for about 2 years, right? We withdrew our last combat forces from Vietnam in 73. Saigon didn't fall until 1975. And I'll admit that I personally probably bought into that, even though it has nothing to do with, it's a whole different war. It's a whole different country. It's American hubris at its, you know, at its finest and its most shallow, right? That we compared these things 45 years apart, be like, oh, okay, that'll work. They, you know, they can hang out for 2 years. And that didn't happen for reasons that I think we're all kind of pretty familiar with. You know, I can't even, you know, a lot of Afghan military units fought very bravely. They weren't enough. And other Afghan units, as the dominoes started to fall, had to make a decision. And I don't know. I've never been standing at a gate, checking my phone, seeing the rest of the country fall, seeing the neighborhood kid that I hadn't seen since I was 12 show up with his Taliban buddies and say, so are we going to kill you or not? You know, I can kind of wrap my head around it, even if it's a bit of a betrayal of soldiering. So That's a long-winded way of saying that I think you're probably onto something, at least back here, that had it been more of a slow burn, the withdrawal would not have stung so many connected to Afghanistan, not just veterans, but aid workers, even journalists, government workers. And the sting for all of them was very pronounced, and I think remains so.
Let's get back to the novel. You have all these interesting things. A large part of the book is kind of Pax wandering around and interacting with Ukraine and the cities and its people and kind of seeing things on the periphery. And I wanted to ask about a couple of these periphery characters that are things that kind of like, it's like Pax abuts these strange worlds and then retreats from them as like the complexity of whatever's going on, like starts to rear its head. One of the scenes kind of earlier on that strikes me is, I believe it's after he's been, he and Lee go to sign up. They take Lee immediately. They can tell that Pax is perhaps not best suited to go to the front, and they tell him no. He ends up wandering, kind of doing a walkabout, and ends up in a like an expat bar, or maybe it's a cafe, where he overhears these guys talking in English, and before he sees them, thinks that they're fellow soldiers. And then it's very obvious that something else is going on there, like when he sees them and when he actually starts talking to them. And I was wondering if you could kind of tell me about that kind of Western character in Ukraine.
Sure. Yeah. So that scene takes place at a KFC. KFC is a prominent feature, at least in the big cities in Ukraine. And yeah, they are somewhat nebulous characters. I don't think Pax really ever definitively figures out who they are. You know, in my head, they are salesmen, business people, probably unaffiliated with the American government, but they are there to make money, and they are there to sell services, equipment, perhaps even weapons to Ukrainian units in need. And early on in this the war, it was pretty decentralized. You know, Ukraine, I think, has gotten better from what I've observed in terms of keeping things everything above the board and controlling all this, for both legal reasons and to appease, the Western governments that it needs continued support from. But getting there as early as we did, we rolled in with these kind of weird, mysterious characters, men in their 50s or 60s, clearly too old to fight, wearing very nice watches, very nice wingtip shoes, talking openly in English, unabashedly in English. And, we talked to a few of them and they, I don't know, oh, well, I'm a contractor, be very vague with what they do, except one conversation we did have, and they didn't know we were writers, certainly. And I had to basically sit on my hands to keep myself from pulling out my notebook. But, American, said he was a military vet, said he had a connection to a warehouse in Romania with 5,000 AK-47s. And he was just looking for the right partner, I believe is the term he used. Never got out of him if he was just there to get those weapons out of the goodness of his heart, or specifically had a price in his mind. But as I was sitting there and I walked home with my friends, I realized how little of that world I've never, I was just a junior officer 10 years ago. I never encountered that world. I vaguely understood that this stuff goes on and exists, and it's this entire ecosystem. And of course, like bugs to a zapper, these forces are going to be drawn to a conflict like Ukraine. But still, sitting at that table, trying to keep it together, trying not to betray. I had no poker face. I'm sure it took him all of 5 minutes to realize we were not worth his time. That scene is lifted directly from kind of personal encounters of like, and much like Pax, realizing that my understanding of global armed conflict is just a very small piece of it. But hey, here's a peephole into a whole nother world. And it's worth thinking about, if nothing else.
Yeah, there's a whole other world of black market logistics that goes into these things, right?
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, I, you know, by giving this interview, I'm probably going to give up any future job prospects in that world. So, you know, road not taken.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, welcome back. The scene, what would I even call this? The mystical barter house?
With dog?
No, with the passport.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. So I loved that sequence. That is, also based on a real place, though it's actually no longer open. But for years in Lviv, there was this very strange alley where kids mostly, but anyone, was encouraged to bring toys to. And you could take a toy out. And I found old pictures of it. I was just, I honestly can't even remember how I encountered it first. Because in reality, it no longer existed in 2022 when we were there. So I might've just been reading like an old guidebook, something like that. And I was just really fascinated by it. And I think I found some reviews online, maybe Google reviews or TripAdvisor or something. And a person went on and on and on about, you know, I visited on this very foggy day and it was really creepy. And I was like, I can tap in. I can use this. So yeah, you know, I just took that glimmer, you know, that shard of research and just kind of maximized it so that when Pax goes there to retrieve an item very dear to him that has been taken, he has nothing to offer except for his passport. And that is like a lot of things Pax does. It's lifted from something Lee had said in a different context earlier, but Pax is just kind of Pax wants to be like Lee in some ways, and wants to be there and wants to show that he's committed. So he has to, you know, this is at a time when the American Assembly has fled Ukraine. So it's not so much a matter of he can just go report and get another one. I think that's Pax's first. One of the themes of the book, I think, is choice. And when we get to really make one and when we need to pretend to make one just to go on with ourselves. But that's Pax's first real choice that I think he makes in this story.
Let's talk about Pax a little bit more. Can I first get you to admit that liking in an aeroplane over the sea and telling a woman that, yes, in fact, that is your favorite song is a giant red flag.
Yeah, I intentionally picked a pretty obnoxious hipster song, both kind of as an Easter egg for myself. I mean, the timing worked out for when they would have been young people and listening to it. But I also needed it to be somewhat like popular enough that, like, you know, Svetlana speaks pretty good English, but it's not her native language. So what's a song she would have encountered, an American song, that would have stuck her with her all these years. And yeah, I think it is a key sign of who Pax was 10 years before and maybe why Svetlana took off for Lviv 10 years prior too.
Right. So at the center of this book is this relationship between Pax and Svetlana. It's this woman that this Ukrainian woman that he'd met, and I would say he fell in love with 10 years earlier. The nature of that love and the maturity of that love, I think, is in question throughout the novel.
Yes.
But can you kind of tell me about their relationship and why you decided to use that as kind of this motivation for Pax?
So I think it started with, I mean, there's something, I'm certainly far from the first writer to find the contrast and dissonance of love, of a love story in the midst of a war, compelling, right? And just great fodder for storytelling. I knew I wanted a prominent Ukrainian character. I needed it, you know, because Pax and Lee kind of came to me first. But I also just, you know, I didn't want to do kind of like, I wanted it to be dark. I knew Pax was already stuck in Afghanistan in a very severe way. So getting him at least psychologically to braid his memories of their relationship, which was though fleeting, was intense. And having him braid in a way I have seen a lot of, not just veterans, but people stuck in their memories, stuck in the past. Everything in that moment was so momentous for him, and he made choices, and he spent the 10 years since believing that they were all the wrong choices, both in the Gunner's Cupola in Afghanistan, when there's a, you know, a large suicide bomber attack. And then what went wrong with this Ukrainian woman who he's thought about a lot, even if it was a fleeting, intense relationship. And at some point over the last 10 years, all of that is braided together. So, you know, like you recall, and anybody listening recalls, when anything that was on the news in mid, late February 2022 was Ukraine. And this question, is this actually happening? Right. It was dislocating. It was surreal for any of us, anybody bothering to pay attention that, like, oh my God, like the possibility of World War III is actually here. That's intensified for him. And he finds himself thinking about this woman even more. And then Lee calls someone out of the blue and says, hey, you want to come? Again, a choice. Though I'm not sure that one is one Pax could have walked away from. He had nothing. He works at AutoZone in Oklahoma. He's miserable. This is at least something different. This is at least something new. And maybe, just maybe, there's somebody over there that needs his help. So it's messed up. It's messed up. It's not a healthy relationship by any means.
You use the word braid when you're talking about the reconstruction of memory. Mm-hmm. Can you go into that a little? Why braid? Why is that the word?
So the epigraph for the book is taken from Conrad's Lord Jim, and it's about memory and kind of like the lurid tricks vanity plays on our memories, you know, to give some pretense to make it live, right? And it basically, you know, it's the way we all kind of bend time, warp memory to be able to go on, to be able to endure. The memory, there's a couple short sections in the book set 10 years prior that explore Svetlana's memory of their relationship, which is very different than Pax's memory. There's a couple moments of overlap, though. There are a couple moments of overlap. And maybe, you know, I still believe in objective truth. It is out there. It's just often hard for us to find, both in the moment and certainly in our memories. So that is something I think we all do with people we care about. And it's also something that I think anybody who's been around armed conflict probably has a version of. You know, the first dead body you come across, the first artillery fire first bomb blast you hear. it elevates us, our senses, and yet it also instantly reminds you how fragile we are, that we are just kind of animals, and very fragile animals at that. How do veterans with PTSD in Pax's case, but even ones that are doing fine, you know, how do our minds make sense of that? How do we contain that to be able to go forward? How do I fashion both in nonfiction and fiction? How do I fashion these moments of real brief, sudden violence surrounded by, you know, gross boredom and waste and ruin? How do I fashion that into narrative? My mind, my memory, my imagination is bending events to be cohesive, to be coherent. We all do this. Pax has done it with two very formative experiences in his life. His relationship with Svetlana that ended poorly and suddenly, and then his time in Afghanistan, which also ends suddenly and poorly.
We tell ourselves stories in order to live, right?
Idiot, yes.
I kept thinking about that while I was reading this, because it's very, I always like, I wouldn't say that Pax is necessarily an unreliable narrator, but I like that there are these, you're so in his head for so much of the book, mm-hmm. But then there are these moments where you pull out and you see what's going on from another person's perspective, and it is not being interpreted or remembered in the same way at all.
Yeah. I knew I wanted to end on a Ukrainian note, so that was important. And then, you know, I think I got that, the original idea for doing that, James Salter's first novel, The Hunters, which is about dog fighters in Korea, does something similar. And I thought it was really cool. And so I was like, well, I can do it too. Nobody reads that book.
There's a great moment where, kind of earlier on, that's a tell where Pax is very taken with a pair of earrings that Svetlana wears to a dinner that they go to. And he's like, those are the earrings I gave her in Milan. She dug them out. Why is she wearing them? And then you get this, he mentions this to her. And then later you have Svetlana thinking from her point of view, it's like, you know, my husband gave me these like 6 years ago. As an anniversary gift or something, right? And it's like, these are not the earrings you think they are. You're seeing what you want to see.
Yeah, that was, you know, just as I was thinking about their differing memories and how they view their relationship 10 years before the way they did. Yeah, I mean, the arrogance of men came up a few times. You know, Pax is not a bombastic type, but he's still a dude. And he still wants to think that he's lived on in her life more than he really has.
And he's an American dude.
Exactly. Right?
I think that's a very important piece of this. I kept thinking about that as I was reading this. So he kind of goes from place to place, repeating almost like a mantra. I want to help. Let me help. I want to help. And everyone's reactions to him are very interesting. Because nobody quite believes him when he says that that's the reason he's there, right?
Right. I mean, because when our first trip, that was we got that question consistently, and we had a very clean answer. Hey, we're working with this small group of civilians on just real basic self-defense, and that seemed to kind of satisfy most of the Ukrainians who asked us. But I was interested you know, there was like a random Canadian there that we encountered who wanted to teach meditation. And he was like, oh, well, let me come to your group and we'll work on meditation. I was like, man, you seem like a really good human being. Why, what are you doing here? You know? And so I think that was the seed for that. And yeah, I mean, you're absolutely like the power dynamic between Svetlana and Pax is something, I enjoy kind of making messy and muddying up and, you know, in many, you know, he's the American. He can leap, come and go whenever he wants. You know, eventually he'll find a passport again or something. She feels somewhat trapped Yes, she's a Ukrainian woman, so she can leave, but she has an estranged husband who's fighting at the front. More pertinently, she has a young son who she wants to raise Ukrainian, and she wants to raise near her near his father. But you know, this war is threatening to trap her the same way Afghanistan trapped PAX. So you know, there's that power dynamic. On the other hand, socially, she kind of comes from a bit of a higher social class. He kind of comes from a working class background. He fell head over heels in love with this Ukrainian woman in Italy who was on her gap year, right? She comes from a little bit more money. She ends up marrying a lawyer. She's up until this war, she's lived a life of relative comfort and ease. PAX has not, you know, PAX has been struggling for 10 years. So in that way, she actually has a bit more power and control of the situation. And I think she's more aware of that disparity than PAX is of his. I don't know. I think if nothing else, I hope that kind of helps readers understand their attraction to each other, at least when they were young people, because they were so different. And oftentimes, maybe it was probably never going to work out, but that doesn't mean it wasn't memorable. That doesn't mean that it didn't mean something in the moment.
Yeah, the only reason these two people met is because they were both kind of lifted out of their circumstances, right? They had to meet each other in completely different contexts.
Yes. Yes. No, I mean, you know, he's a PAX was an enlisted guy stationed in Italy, completely out of his depth, serving his country. In no normal circumstances do they cross paths, but they did. And what does that mean, both for their past selves and then their current selves when they find each other and need to at least work together to try to help someone.
All right, let's get to some into the book spoilers if we can here at the end of the conversation, if that works for you.
Let's do it.
Mr. Graves, nice moment there at the end. I'm wondering if that grave that he finds, is that real?
It is. It is.
Okay.
I took some liberties with kind of how it's described. But yeah, that Edmund Pike Graves is buried at that cemetery in Lviv.
When did you know that PAX was doomed?
Unlike, you know, this is my third novel. And the other two I really had to wrench out of me. I probably at the very beginning, I didn't want to write. Keeping him alive just would have felt cheap in some way.
It almost makes him a tourist more than so than he already is, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Like if I was going to end with him actually finding a way to help, there needed to be some consequence. There needed to be real cost. Otherwise it's a redemption story and a clean redemption story. And I didn't want to write Christ, that probably would have sold a lot more copies. So maybe, but it just wasn't the book I wanted to write. That said, when I got to it, I'll admit, I was like, oh man, I've been really hard on him already. Am I really going to do this? And it just, I couldn't, any other avenue, it just didn't feel right. Whereas this, you know, the story, the whole book kind of tumbled out of me in a much cleaner way than my previous books had. So I just had to see it through.
If he goes, so for people that maybe need a refresher or just listen to the episode, Svetlana's husband is wounded in the east, in the southeast, and they have to go, she needs someone to go get the body. They assume that he is dead, and they're going to go pick up the body. It's a little bit unclear. He's been wounded, but presumed dead. They get there, and, PAX essentially is volunteered by her friends and accepts the role of driving. He's a mechanic. He knows cars. A lot of the cars in the area are crappy. So he's gonna drive. He will get her there. Let him do this, I think he says. They get there and husband is alive. It was a miracle. He pulled through. Now they got to get him back. And in the process of getting them back, Pax is shot and dies rather quickly. And I'm thinking, like, if all of this stuff had happened and he had gotten out, it almost would have felt like a weird American exploitation novel, right? Like, this is the American experience of the Ukrainian war. They've come and they've done their tour and then they get to go home and he learns something that he gets to take with them. And maybe he quits and goes to college instead of continuing on at AutoZone, right? And that would have felt less serious, I think, as a novel. And it would have kind of kind of encouraged this idea that an American man that can do a redo on his war and go and pick up another war somewhere else and then come home and be healed in some way, right?
Yeah, I did not want this to be read. It's this interesting thing because we came back so early and we did that CNN spot with Anderson Cooper. We all fielded a lot of queries from other vets on should I go? And I was like, I can't answer that for you. I don't want to encourage you to do it. Over 50 Americans have been killed there. The vast majority of them are military veterans. This is very real, and not to take away from whatever you saw or did before, but this is different. I mean, there's cruise missiles, there's artillery. It is breaking hardened soldiers. Same time, I don't want to it's not for me to discourage, because it would be completely hypocritical, like be like, oh, you can't do it. There's no way you can help, because there might be. It needs to be an educated choice. So I was keenly aware, maybe I think from having dealt with all of that, that if I'd written it the way you put it, and he comes back with grizzled, hard-earned wisdom from the front, and starts campaigning at telling congressmen to pass Ukraine aid, blah blah blah. It would be cheerleading. It would mm-hmm. be cheerleading, and trying to maintain the balance between encouragement and discouragement. Having him be killed in a brutal and violent and sudden way just seemed more honest than the other choices. And, I think it fit into the story, right? He dies and Taras lives. Dennis gets to keep his father. Svetlana will always remember him in a way that she probably wouldn't have had he not gotten on that plane and gone to Ukraine. That's really sad. It's really dark. It's pretty cool for a book.
How have reactions been to the ending?
It's the first thing people want to talk about. Some really like it, some hate it. I've come to realize it means it's memorable. I got yelled at church last week for it by an old lady who also didn't like all the curse words. But good on her. Good on her. 75-year-old Oklahoma Presbyterian reading a book like this, and then having the confidence to come up and tell the author, I read it. Parts of it were good. Here's what I didn't like. So it does seem to be not when you said the last 50 pages were especially memorable to you. I've heard that a lot. Really, it's chapter 9. Chapter 9 is mm-hmm. the biggest chapter in the book, and I just wanted to pack everything else before that is kind of the slow burn up to it. And then it kind of takes on a different momentum. If it's memorable, that hopefully means I did something right.
Yeah. All the characters that are in that car get clarified in a way in that last chapter, Roman and is it Brodigan?
Bogdan.
Yeah. An unknown and like this surreal road trip that they go on could almost be like that could be the whole film if you were going to make the movie, mm-hmm. right? It would just be that like 90 minutes of that journey back and forth is how I would structure it.
Oh, interesting. And then you'd like flash back to the other chapters. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You start off with them just in the car going And then, yeah, you build everything else through flashback and conversation in the car would be how I would do the screenplay. Anyway, one more side character I did want to talk about before I let you go. You already mentioned him. Dog.
Mm-hmm.
Did you meet a dog? Did you go to a museum with a little green man statue?
We met versions of dog. I think it was important to include him. He's a nationalist, right-wing leader. Maybe not Azov exactly, but certainly Azov, aligned around Azov. And I think it was important to include him. There's a lot of Western obsession with that aspect of the Ukrainian military and culture, even if it is small, it is there. For the same reason I didn't, I've talked kind of at length about keeping my American veterans complex and not steering into a hero story or jingoism or whatever. Dog was a way maybe for me to complicate the Ukrainian people, right? This is a sovereign democracy that deserves our support and deserves to defend itself. But it's flawed. It's dealt with corruption issues. Those are real. It's trying to figure this out in many ways on the fly. And that is hard when you have power brokers like Dog, influential leaders in their community who have been and are using the war for personal benefit. They're also proud Ukrainians. They're proud nationalists. They hate the Russians. They hate Putin. As we saw in Mariupol at the steelworks, sometimes those guys make really excellent soldiers. That's a weird thing to reconcile. I mean, Ukraine is itself is, there's kind of a war for memory going on there, because what those guys did was legitimately heroic. Every recruiting or reporting trip I've taken since, you have to know, Ukraine has to trust you a lot and know you already to be willing to deal to, at least as an American, as an American writer, to talk to you about the nuance in all that. 99% of people, whatever their politics, and most people's politics are not like that. They showed us the way forward. We are here because of them. That's going to be something whenever this war ends after, decades after, Ukraine is going to be sorting through. Putting my dopey American, ignorant American, in conversation with Dog, in his museum, Dog thinks he's like some other Americans he's encountered, connected, more willing to work in kind of the black market. So Dog is almost unintentionally honest with Pax and thus the reader in a way he never would be if he actually understood who Pax is and how little connected Pax is. I can't say Dog is based off of one guy we met, maybe a composite. And the museum is just, I think, was just kind of a clean, neat, physical way for me to show these types obsessions with history and nationalism, right? Like, having a map on the wall allows me to describe it in scene rather than exposition.
Yeah, and there's something fascinating about having a museum like that and then having what is effectively a trophy for Dog. What Dog tells Pax is like his kill. Like, this is the guy I killed. Here was his sniper rifle. Here's all of his armor. Here's the story of me killing him. And I have placed this monument in this museum as part of this continuity of history.
Yeah, he's a disturbed individual. He disturbs readers. But I'll admit, like, it was maybe intellectually important to include him for all the reasons I already said. He was also just a lot of fun to write. he's kind of psychotic. And yet there is this kind of, I leave readers with this question, this discomfort of like, is he actually good for the war effort? He's certainly bad for his country. But he might be good for the war effort. And sometimes those things conflict. And What does that mean going forward?
Oh, that's the kind of note I like to end on. that kind of ambiguity. Matt Gallagher, thank you so much for coming on to Angry Planet and walking us through Daybreak. Glad to have you on again. What are you working on now?
Oh,
selling Daybreak?
No. My 6-year-old who has not read the book wants to write a sequel. I don't have the heart to tell him. I don't think there's anybody left to do it with. Maybe a couple side characters, but
well, I could read a, you know, I wouldn't hate reading a Merriman book.
Ooh, you know what? That's you're onto something there. Yeah, that was another character I really kind of enjoyed writing, and then there's that one section that I think deepens him tremendously from his perspective.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful scene. That's a really great and telling scene, I thought, and that one I will let people discover. In the book.
Appreciate that. As for what I'm working on now, I am I'm sick of writing current affairs. I've really only just started, but started research and sketching out ideas. But I'm writing about 1860s Nevada. I'm originally from Nevada, and the state really was built up by folks, veterans and civilians from the Civil War that were looking to start a new life. And I don't know. I'm wondering if maybe there's some answers in there about what, you know, America's trying to figure out what we are in the 21st century, and not the first time we've had to do a real deep reckoning with ourselves. I'm excited to write about my old home, and then B, I'm wondering if maybe there's some answers to some of my questions in the past. So, but it's really vague. I'm not even just staying vague because we're on a podcast. It's all very barely sketched out at this point. But I'm excited about it.
I look forward to reading it. I like that era of American history, so I will definitely be there when it comes out.
Appreciate it, Matthew. Always a pleasure talking with you.
Always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. All right, that's all for this episode. Angry Planet listeners, as always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin O'Dell. It was created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like the show, if you really like the show, please go to angryplanetpod.com and give us $9 a month. It gives you instant access to all the bonus content. There's a really great Matt Gallagher episode from about a month ago that is about some literary controversies that people have really loved and responded to very well. So if you want to listen to that, go to angryplanetpod.com and sign up. You will also get commercial-free versions of the mainline episodes. So if you are hearing this and you heard commercials during the episode, go to angryplanetpod. You can get a private RSS feed into whatever app that you use to listen to your podcasts and skip those commercials. We will be back next week with more conversations about conflict on an angry planet. I've got some really great stuff recorded. Really amazing reporting out of Russia that I'm excited for y'all to hear. For subscribers only, that one, though. So, again, angryplanetpod.com. We'll be back soon with another conversation about conflict on an angry planet. Stay safe until then.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.